So I'm now in San Jose. Do you want to introduce yourselves?
I'm Brian Henley.
Ian Martin.
Alicia Navarro.
Ali Lanoma.
Okay, well, let's start with talking about the city itself. Population of San Jose, I think someone was telling me it's about 1 million and then another couple of million in the immediate area. Probably well known because it's near Silicon Valley. So what sort of work do people do here?
I think Silicon Valley, it's a lot of the tech type things, computers, that sort of thing.
A lot of service jobs, of course, like hotel industry for businessmen, restaurants. Then for a lot of the tech companies, there's a lot of like cafeteria workers and that kind of thing, which is contracted out.
Huge numbers of temps for all those kinds of jobs, including your clerical and administrative work.
Construction workers too.
And in terms of characteristics, what would you say kind of makes San Jose different from the other U.S. cities?
I would say like we're like sprawled out really wide kind of, and especially the surrounding cities are like part of us too. So like Saratoga, Cupertino, stuff like that. So we're interacting with those other parts too. Public transportation system isn't that great, so you basically need a car to get anywhere. That also kind of separates people as far as community goes. Like downtown isn't as vibrant as other downtown cities maybe because of that.
In terms of issues in the city, like what sort of issues do people face?
There's a lot of police brutality and racial profiling, sort of tracking people into jail, especially young Latino folks, a lot of Asian folks also getting tracked in there.
Our police is really bad here, right?
Yeah, the police issue has been like a long-running issue in San Jose. They've been, I'm going back to like, from what I understand to like the 50s, they've been like resistance to the police, there have been riots against the police. There's been a lot of like undocumented history that deal with like police repression, and it's kind of cultivated to like people, every generation resisting it but not making like a historical connection to like what the previous generation did. So every year like this something brings up like the police issue and people kind of resist it, and like and they find like new ways of like dealing with it. But for people who've been around the block, some of the people here know kind of like the historical implications of like the police here and how that plays out with like the political landscape in terms of how they use the police to, gentrify the city, how to bring developers, how they push people out, how they push out the homeless, and how sometimes they kind of use really whack policy to kind of create this facade of how they want to present San Jose to the rest of the world. For example, San Jose is supposed to be one of the safest major cities in the United States. And the numbers say that, you know, homelessness has gone down, poverty has gone down. But really what's the real story from the people that live here, poverty hasn't really gone down, just it's been pushed out. You know, people are still poor. People are still coming to San Jose, still working 9 to 5, but they live, you know, several hours away. They commute, they come here. They just don't have the luxury to live in the condos that they're now building.
Yeah, I definitely think that's true about what the image that they're putting out for other people. If you look at the downtown area too, like a lot of the places that we used to know, like the Cactus Club, like a music spot or whatever, is being changed. Like those places are being changed into something else more appealing to like an upscale sort of thing. We have like upscale shopping areas like Santana Row that was built to cater to that, and people go there to shop mainly, and so the businessmen too that come down to downtown. So it's like really looks, if you go walk around, it looks like it's, oh, a happy little world. And then the other part to it is what Ali said, what's the real true ways that they're enforcing that new image.
And then also, of course, kind of the workers who have to hold it all up, like the temp workers, the immigrant workers, who say run these cafeterias for the high-tech workers or who work in Santana Row. And then also this whole workforce is either like marginalized or temporary, so kind of this idea of how we're gonna, those workers are gonna organize themselves, I guess.
I'd also say housing is a big thing here, that it's real hard to organize around, and I know that people have done it in the past, but there's actually a law that's gonna be going through, or there's a proposition on the ballot to remove rent control, make it illegal and abolish it. And this is at a time when wages have been falling and housing prices have been increasing. So, you know, the material struggle of people is pretty rough, and I think people are having to have a lot of jobs, multiple jobs, especially if there's a family. So, you know, the struggles of people are, it's real hard to be public or loud about it, because if you go out in the street, you're going to get harassed by the cops. So public demonstrations are actually not as common or not as safe, I guess, as you might hope. If you're going to be waging movements to, like, really make change, you want to be able to be public and loud about it. But the police really are very good about just silencing dissent. Even just people walking around, you know, if there's groups of three or more people that wear the same clothes or look like the stereotypical gangster, they get harassed immediately. It's really, there's a lot of fear. The police instill a lot of fear in the community. And we're trying to organize against it. I mean, there's attempts at getting Cop Watch up and running here in San Jose. There's an intake center through Debug, Silicon Valley Debug, that people can go and make complaints against the police without having to go talk to the police or have to go talk to city bureaucrats who might, you know, ask them questions that they don't necessarily want to answer, because I think a lot of people stay quiet about the abuse that they experience because, you know, going and talking to authorities, well, it's the authorities that are doing it or are responsible for it. And so that's something that's hopeful.
Well, it's the world's largest flea market. Probably it's our landmark. We don't have huge buildings. We don't have any statues of liberty. But I think the flea market, whether it's recognized or not, it's been our symbol in a lot of ways for San Jose. And I think a few years there was talks of the owners selling it to private developers for a lot of different reasons. It's closely tied to creating like condensed housing, so they can get federal grants to bring in the BART system, which is the Bay Area Rapid Transit, which is I don't know how you guys would explain it. This
kind of train,
the train light rail system that connects the East Bay to San Francisco and to other parts of the Bay Area. So the bums, the people that own the flea market, decided to sell off the land to developers and just build kind of like a Santana Row like shopping center, where you get really, you know, bougie boutiques that kind of cater to a very niche group of people. To make a long story short, like, through about 3,000 people who normally go there to get their groceries on a given weekend are going to have to find different places to go grocery shopping. Not only is it a place where, like, certain material patterns are going to be completely destroyed, but also, like, this cultural center that's existed in San Jose is completely going to be demolished just because a couple of owners, you know, had a backdoor meeting, decided, hey, you know, this is not important for the people.
And if you look at the people who go to the flea market, it's a lot of people of color, basically. Look around, like, that's all it is. Yeah, that's all really it is. You go there, so kind of like they like to take things that no one they think is going to make a big ruckus about, but people actually are doing that right now. So we went over there the other day, and there's a big sign that says, oh, we're not closing down, but, you know, you can't trust their promise there. So we do have in San Jose, we have two large immigrant communities, that's Vietnamese and Mexican. So it's throughout that demographic.
So in terms of the kind of local left and anarchist movement, what exists in this city?
I think the thing about San Jose is there's not really a history of, like, an established left. Although if you go back to the 60s, there was, like, the Brown Berets, a lot of that type of organizing as far as the left goes. But I think, in a way,
you say with the Brown Berets.
Oh, okay. Brown Berets were kind of similar to the Black Panthers before the Chicano community. It's kind of like revolutionary nationalism, like blended with Marxism in a way. My dad was actually part of them back in the day. But anyway, but as far as recent times, you know, history, San Jose doesn't really have that much history of an established left, especially compared to San Francisco and Berkeley, which is more famous for that. And, you know, a lot of leftists, when they get older, college age, they actually, like, leave San Jose for those cities, which is annoying to me. But I think we've actually been fortunate in that way, as far as, like, those of us who are anarchists or part of the left in the San Jose, because it leaves us free to avoid some of the like petty conflicts and stuff that come with that, and also we're free to kind of create our own culture, like left culture in San Jose, and I think we're fortunate because of that, that we can kind of put our own stamp on it.
Maybe because we have two people here that were part of another org, like a Furious Five, and that was, didn't that make a big splash as far as the anarchist scene goes when you guys were out there, or?
Maybe not in San Jose, but maybe to the broader like anarchist movement type folks we talked to, it was something different, but not to the folks in our immediate circle of friends in San Jose. As far as anarchist stuff, I think, I don't know, I think before I got involved, the only thing I knew about anarchism was Food Not Bombs, which is, I think we've all somehow been involved in Food Not Bombs in one way or another, maybe through friends or doing the work. Essentially, it's a group of people who go to parks and provide food for homeless people and provide radical literature. And a lot of the people that do that tend to be anarchists. But in terms of like other left organizations in San Jose, the CP has been around in San Jose, but in small pockets. They're not loud, visible. They're generally like school teachers, people who go out to different events. A lot of them aren't really gung-ho CP members. They're just there because they somehow got sucked into the party. They liked some of the ideas of like the CP. San Jose has also had, in Japantown, I think San Jose is one of the few cities in the United States that has a Japantown, maybe out of like a handful of, maybe five other cities that has a Japantown. But in Japantown, I think in the 70s, there was a collective of communists. They're part of a larger organization called the League of Revolutionary Struggle. And they're called the J-Town Collective. And they did a lot of kind of working with Asian youth who were involved in like gang activity, and they kind of they recruited out of that base and raised their consciousness and kind of plugged them into different like social movement stuff. And a lot of kind of like on the ground work was based out of San Francisco, so they would get a lot of their members from San Jose and plug them into San Francisco. But San Jose, besides like having that type of left ideological kind of identity, it's been based more around like social movements that haven't had the privilege of becoming institutionalized in one way or another. Therefore, like, the history or the legacy doesn't get passed down.
You mentioned Furious Five there. A lot of people are curious. Superheroes, what was that?
So, Furious Five was a collective that came out of, all of us who ended up being part of it were part of this group, Students for Justice, which was a student group coming out of community colleges in the South Bay, organizing around a few different issues, mainly the budget cuts and fee increases in education, and we kind of tried to bring like a race and class analysis to that issue, which wasn't really happening around that, and also some other issues like anti-war, anti-police brutality. So kind of coming out of that, a few of us realized that we kind of were on the same page, anarchist beliefs, whatnot, and we decided to form this collective to get together and discuss our organizing work and our experiences. And so that's how the Furious Five was formed. And people always assume that there was five of us because of the name, but that was just the name.
I think a lot of our culture, because we're, the people here in San Jose, in Amanacer and our close circle friends, it's a small group, therefore we have a lot of internal jokes, and I think the name came out of like an inside joke, and it was more or less a homage to Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, and kind of like the jokes we had around that, and kind of like our respect to some of the early pioneers of that genre of music.
As far as Furious Five goes, I think a lot of what we were struggling with at that time was, I think something that the anarchist movement in general was doing at that time was coming to this realization that, oh, we needed to actually be doing organizing work and social movements instead of just debating with each other, instead of just going to, say, like the summit protests or anti-war protests, that we needed to be doing like day-to-day work to help you know, help people build their own sense of, like, collective power. And the thing was, it wasn't just some kind of realization that we came to, but I think a lot of it came from stuff we were doing in Students for Justice and those experiences and, like, seeing, like, how that actually happened concretely and wanting to... I mean, a lot of our early history was kind of debates with other anarchists, but it was focused on, like, you know, trying to get across this point that, oh, as anarchists, we should be doing, like, this concrete organizing work instead of, you know, debates with each other, necessarily.
Okay, so for you are currently involved in Alan Slayer. Do you want to sort of tell us a bit about that?
I would say that we, because we did have roots in SFJ, and then some of the members became Furious Five, and then, so it was all, like, leading up to, I would say, Amana said, and we tried different routes to get there, including an ideal of building a federation. So we had a Furious Five, the A-Team, which was in the Mighty East Bay, and then I think that was, and then we had one person in San Francisco trying to, and it didn't work out quite like we imagined. I think mainly because we were at different levels. We're trying to build a federation, but then the two of the groups weren't as up to par or up to speed as Furious Five was, so it kind of brought up different issues, but I think we also wanted to change the direction that we were going, and instead of being separate locals, collectives, we wanted to be just one. So all that whole thing that we were trying with Furious Five, the A-Team, and San Francisco was called ACU, and then we disbanded that, took the time to rethink it, and then we all had a retreat where everyone came together as one, and we built, like, our mission statement and everything at that retreat and went on from there. Like, on the road to that, we also had to deal with, like, gender issues, things around the type of language we used to build the mission statement and what that kind of meant, what that portrayed. We had to deal with that sort of thing.
I think especially some of us from Furious Five, we were really hot on the federation idea, you know, even to the point where we were so focused on the model, we didn't think about what, like, the immediate circumstances called for. And that's when we reconvened to start Amanecer, including some folks who ended up being part of what is now the LA local. We kind of had this idea that it might be better if we just had a single organization with locals, because it was this idea if we were all part of one organization that it would create a greater sense of unity and being part of one thing instead of part of separate collectives, which was problematic as far as the question of being on different levels. So that's kind of how that came about.
Yeah, I think, like, our early political inspiration came from debates going on in the anarchist milieu in the United States, particularly the debate on which direction to grow and how to grow. And I think earlier on we took a lot of our cues from, like, NEFAC and BTR, and we looked at them like, okay, well, which direction are they going? How does that affect our strategy? Will that work here? And we experimented, and I think at the end it was all, like, a really good learning experience. And I think here we are today, learning with each step that we take.
Maybe we should say a little bit about, like, now, what we're focused on, I guess. Because I think based on, like, after the talk with Andrew Flood, you, and also we had a private chat afterwards, and then people lingered on afterwards, after that even more. But talking with everyone that day, I just felt like just building a community. I think one of the biggest focus is on relationships and making true connections with people, and then politics too. Like, we're doing social and political, like, everything mixed all together. And I think that's kind of what makes us strong, and also what makes people think, "Whoa, what are you guys doing? This is something different," I guess, in their experience. And I think it also appeals to everyday people and people who are on the periphery, like, thinking like about anarchism. And maybe wanted to go down that route themselves.
Yeah, I think we kind of moved to a place where we want to be really approachable as far as toning down some of the language we used in Furious 5 about, like, oh, being a revolutionary, being militant, this and that, and realizing that being a revolutionary or an anarchist isn't so much about being this, like, finished project, like, something you are, is more something you strive towards, that it's a process. And I think that also takes away some of the burden of, you know, oh, how do I join this organization? I'm not, like, a full-fledged revolutionary or anarchist. Like, I have to read all these texts and, like, meet all these criteria to do it. But it makes it more open to everyday people that, you know, we're not perfect by any means, and we're trying to struggle with these questions, and inviting them into that process of struggling and figuring out how we are going to do these big things instead of presenting ourselves as some finished, like, answer to that.
One of the underlying values that we have, I don't know if it's expressed or not, is that we put our, kind of like our mass work, sometimes ahead of, like, the organization itself. Sometimes if we don't have the place where we can organize or share the ideas, sometimes the organization itself can be irrelevant. Because I think there's this tendency to place an organization or kind of like this community above kind of like the personal relationships that you've developed through your organizing efforts. But here we're kind of trying to flip that and saying, well, you know, it's the relationships from the organizing that's more important than like the organization. The organization just is a vehicle to kind of support that and allow people to create more of that in the Bay Area and, you know, develop a deeper consciousness and hopefully sort of militancy at the work site, at the campaign, in class, or wherever people are organizing.
Yeah, in terms of actual work that members are doing, what sort of things are going on?
Yeah, this is Brian. The work I've been doing recently is with the Silicon Valley Debug Intake Complaint Center for getting complaints from people about police brutality and judicial misconduct, and also doing Cop Watch, which allows people to take cameras out and actually film what's going on in their neighborhoods, which hopefully someday everybody will be a cop watcher. They'll just have their cameras ready all the time, and if they see somebody getting beat, they'll just film it and share that with the person that got beat.
And then I think a lot of us are involved in labor stuff, and one thing that is significant is we're probably all around the same age. So there, at one time, we were doing a lot of student, like maybe most of us were doing student things, but this is pre-Amana said, but, and then now we have jobs, a lot of us have jobs, so then we went to the labor. That's kind of our new thing. I don't know, that's kind of strange too.
Yeah, I think a lot of us are involved in like work in mainstream labor unions. Like I'm a shop steward with Hotel Workers Union, HERE. Interesting thing is when I first got into it, it was just like a vague idea of, oh, I want to do labor organizing and I don't know where to start, so here's like a place to start. I think after, you know, talking to other people in Amonestad about it and other people are doing this work, I've kind of come to some kind of idea of how to move forward with it, which is not necessarily about trying to reform the union, like get new officers in place or not, because that's the same thing as like getting new politicians in place, but it's more about building people's power at the work site, like independently from the union, maybe working with the union sometimes or not, but it's more about building people's like independent power there. So hopefully that's kind of the work I think a lot of us are doing right now.
This is Ali. I also come from a background of student organizing in community colleges. I've done some support work with a group of amazing community members who've had, you know, family members get beaten or sometimes even killed by the police in San Jose. There was a huge effort a couple years ago to ban the use of electronic tasers in San Jose. And San Jose was one of the first cities to introduce tasers across their entire police force. And that pretty much put a target on any activist or anybody that the police wanted to beat down, and unfortunately they so I was involved in supporting that effort. Right now my effort is what some would call ethnic organizing, community organizing. I really don't know. I've been told a lot of different labels, but my vision is to step into a community that I'm a part of, which is the local Afghan community in Fremont. It turns out to be the largest Afghan population outside of Afghanistan. It has a lot of different like class dynamics, internal ethnic rivalries, and I think there's this new generation of young people who are kind of like seeking a generational calling besides, you know, going to school, working a 9-to-5, and there's this need to express themselves and kind of explore the world and do different things. And I kind of see myself as building something that allows them to connect to the left, whether it be, you know, activism, workplace organizing, going to events, or possibly, hopefully, doing campaign work in the community. I kind of see myself allowing something like that to exist in that area. And I'm working with a group of young folks to establish that.
Okay, and so the traditional end question I have for the interviews is I ask people what they make of the whole U.S. election situation. It's been rolling on for me throughout the tour, and it's still going as far as I understand, so what are your thoughts on it?
Should I admit this on here? But I'm going to vote. I am going to vote for Obama. But I guess I don't know. I can't really say. I mean, the thing is that, like, okay, so I was watching TV and I get caught up in all the thing. But when we stopped getting cable, then I wasn't really following it too much. But I can see that a lot of people are talking about it, like it's going to be the thing that's going to change the world. This one guy, Obama, and I know that that's not true, but I still want to just vote for fun. I know it's not going to change things, you know, but, like, out of the two, I guess I'll go for that one, but...
I think for me, one thing I've been thinking about, like, after talking with a lot of people at work about this is a lot of times we tend to think of people as being really, like, wedded to this electoral system somehow, you know, and so we have this knee-jerk reaction of telling people, like, oh, don't vote, don't do this. I think for a lot of people it's really practical, like, survival, like, tool, along with a lot of other things that they do, like, oh, we're going to vote for this guy, not because we think it's going to make things change the world necessarily, but it's more so, like, one practical thing, maybe it'll make a difference. So, I think it's important, like, when talking about the issue with people to not just totally be like dogmatic or ideological about it with them, so you're really like engaging with them. I think as far as Obama goes, it's just kind of a thing of he's just selling like or kind of pandering because people do want to change, and he doesn't even really have to say what his positions are because his positions are pretty much like everyone else, same as Clinton. But he's just selling this mythology of like changing the world, and it's something that people are really buying into. So it's interesting to see if he does become president and, you know, same old stuff keeps happening, what people's reactions will be, if they'll totally get demoralized or if it'll, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens.
I can't vote. I'm not a citizen. But if my family was a citizen, I probably, you know, I don't know if I would vote for Obama. Part of me says, you know, it'd be a good idea to vote for him just to say, look, I did it. And now, look, he wasn't able to, like, come through on all his promises. Because I don't have faith in the electoral process. I don't have faith in voting for a president. I mean, that political... You know, with that said, part of me wants to go through the process and say, hey, look, I went through what I'm supposed to go through, but I'm still getting jacked. I still have this 9-to-5. I still don't have insurance. My tuition is still going up. Nothing has changed. So what else can we dream of? What else can we do? I'd probably do something like that. And my other side says, you know what, just write in, like, a friend's name, you know. And if anybody's listening to this, vote for Gerald Smith. It's kind of like a Bay Area inside thing.
Okay, this is Brian. Let's see here. I like having conversations with people about where they're at and, you know, whatever political thing they're thinking of. If they want to talk about the election, I'll talk about the election. But usually they've got a reason, like there's an issue that they're really hot on, or maybe two or three. And a lot of times it has to do with civil liberties and, you know, like, sort of the creeping fascism that's anyway, that's starting to actually get said by people that are kind of like Democrats or sort of mainstream folks. They're really worried about sort of police state stuff, and that's like really scary to me, because like I've been thinking about that for a while, and I was thinking, you know, police state, you know, the minute that I saw the Twin Towers come down, I thought, oh God, you know, they're going to come after all the activists and everything, you know, any dissent is going to be crushed. And I think, like, you know, hearing from other people that are like more mainstream, that they're worried about that stuff too, that, you know, the government is spying on them and messing with them, like, that's kind of encouraging. I don't think Obama would stop doing that. I doubt he would risk anything to stop it, but at least he kind of, I don't know, it's interesting to hear the discourse, because it doesn't come up as civil liberties. They don't ever talk about it that way. And so I don't put any faith in it with any politician, but, you know, I am going to vote at least no on Prop 98, which is that housing thing, to get rid of rent control in California here. So vote no on that. And, you know, anything else, yeah, you know, I'm not voting for Hillary Clinton. She's, you know, I don't know. It would probably be Obama, but it's not something that, honestly, I try to take the conversations away from that particular electoral thing into what the issues are that they care about with my family and stuff.
I think for the election, they use a lot of, like, if you see the kind of the posters they're putting out for Obama, or like the images, the graphics and stuff, it's all like using our kind of, you know, like what we do. And so they're using those strategies, and they're using our rhetoric kind of in a way, so that's good to me, because it's like, then regular people are saying that stuff too, and then I know it's their strategy to get in the White House, but it can be our strategy to also like to have those conversations with people, and I think that's what people's true desires are anyway. So kind of what they're talking about, the change and everything, so just use it as a tool. I think that's what the election is basically for me, use it as a tool.